From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Four Plowshares activists prayed and threw their own blood on the deck of a warship yesterday in New York.
The USS the Philippine Sea is an instrument of death that has delivered death in Iraq, in Kosovo, and Afghanistan, and it's our responsibility as citizens of the United States to disarm it.
Today, we'll speak with the four Plowshares activists who were arrested yesterday for their act. We'll also go to Baltimore to speak with two nuns who face long sentences for another Plowshares action. And we'll remember Phil Berrigan, a World War II veteran who is a leader of the anti-war movement for decades. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a scenario similar to the shooting death of Amadou Diallo, the New York City Police Department is coming under fierce criticism for the death of Ousmane Zango on Thursday. Both came to New York from West Africa in search of a better life. Both were shot dead by police. Both were unarmed. Both had no criminal record. The 43-year-old Ousmane Zango fixed African artifacts for a living in the Chelsea section of Manhattan. It was there that he encountered 25-year-old Officer Brian Conroy, who was in the building investigating a CD bootleg operation. Police said Zango approached an undercover officer. For some reason, a chase ensued that ended when Zango ran into a dead end. Conroy then shot him five times. Zango suffered wounds to the abdomen, chest, and upper back and was grazed on the right arm. Conroy told officers at the scene that Zango reached for his gun, but there were no witnesses to confirm this. At a rally on Saturday, the Reverend Al Sharpton said the shooting was unjustified, saying, "I don't know any unarmed man who would pick a fight with a police officer." The shooting came less than a week after the New York police mistakenly raided the Harlem home of Alberta Spruill. Police burst into her apartment at 6 in the morning, exploded a flash grenade, handcuffed the 57-year-old city employee. Then they realized they had the wrong apartment. Alberta Spruill died of a heart attack a few hours later. Mayor Michael Bloomberg said the deaths of the two unarmed New Yorkers during police raids should never have happened, but are not signs of a trend. Alberta Spruill was buried on Saturday. For the first time in its history, the Israeli government has accepted the creation of a Palestinian state. On Sunday, by one vote more than the majority needed, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's cabinet approved steps set out in the U.S. roadmap to peace. But the Washington Post points out the Israeli cabinet avoided saying it accepted the roadmap itself. President Bush is expected to travel to the region next month for discussions with the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers Ariel Sharon and Mahmoud Abbas. Israeli officials said U.S. pressure played a major role in the vote. Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert told Israeli radio, "I think the document is not a good one, but we have to choose when we battle the U.S., and now is not the time." The Guardian of London reports General Sharon told his cabinet he was not happy with the roadmap, but it was, quote, the best alternative available. Meanwhile, the BBC reports Israeli forces today blew up two West Bank homes, killing seven people. The London Observer is reporting the U.S. is illegally holding up to 3,000 Iraqi prisoners of war in Iraq. In violation of the Geneva Convention, human rights officials and the Red Cross have been denied access to the captives. A French television cameraman who was wrongly arrested and briefly detained got a rare glimpse inside the prison. He said he saw hundreds of men hooded with their arms tied behind their backs. No Iraqis have yet been released from the compound. The prison camp located near the Baghdad airport also contains hundreds of civilians who were detained for looting. A mutiny occurred at the beginning of last week at the camp. A U.S. military official told The Observer the U.S., quote, dealt with the rebellion. He did not confirm nor deny that any Iraqis were killed. First, it was Iraq, now Iran. The Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration appears set to call for the destabilization of the Iranian government. The Pentagon is urging President Bush to approve public and private actions that could lead to the toppling of the government. Senior Bush administration officials are scheduled to meet tomorrow at the White House to discuss the future of Iran, which has been accused of housing al-Qaeda leaders who played in the Saudi Arabia car bombings. The Guardian of London reports the British government opposes any move toward regime change in Iran. The Bush administration is reportedly pressing the International Atomic Energy Agency to issue a critical report next month on Iran's nuclear activities. The Pentagon plan may involve the Iraq-based armed opposition movement Mujahideen Khalq, even though it is designated a terrorist group by the State Department. In this news from Afghanistan, some 2,200 demonstrators threw rocks and cement at the U.S. Embassy this weekend and attacked international peacekeepers in a protest sparked by the killing of three Afghan soldiers last week by U.S. Marines. The Marines mistook the Afghans for enemy combatants and opened fire. The Washington Post is revealing that the New York Times top reporter on bioterrorism, Judith Miller, acknowledged to her colleagues that her main source for many of her articles has been Ahmed Chalabi, the controversial exile leader who is close to top Pentagon officials. In a column in today's Post, media critic Howard Kurtz asks how Chalabi has been using the Times to build a drumbeat that Iraq was hiding weapons of mass destruction. Miller's reliance on Chalabi was revealed after the Post obtained email correspondence between Miller and the Times' Baghdad bureau chief, John Burns. Miller has drawn criticism for her reporting on the hunt for Iraqi weapons while she was embedded with the MET Alpha unit. In an April 21st front-page story, she reported that a leading Iraqi scientist claimed Iraq had destroyed chemical and biological weapons days before the war began. This according to the Alpha team. In that story, she acknowledged that military officials had delayed the publication of the article and that the text of the article was submitted for approval to the military. Since then, the Washington Post reports no evidence has surfaced to support these claims, and the Alpha team is preparing to leave Iraq without having found weapons of mass destruction. And in other news from Iraq, the U.S.-run Iraqi administration has canceled or suspended three oil contracts with Russian and Chinese firms signed by the ousted government of Saddam Hussein. The U.S.-appointed Iraq oil minister, Thamir Ghadban, said on Saturday all pre-war contracts will be reevaluated and new deals announced soon.
Up, two, three, four, marching down the street, rolling of the drums and the tramping of the feet, general salutes and the mothers waving we. Here comes the big parade, don't be afraid. Price is paid, one more parade. So young, so strong, so ready for the war. So willing to go and die upon a foreign shore. All march together, everybody looks the same. So there is no one you can blame. Don't be ashamed, light the flame, one more parade. Listen for the sound and listen for the noise. Listen for the thunder of the marching boys. Few years ago, their guns were only toys. Here comes the big parade. Don't be afraid, price is paid, one more parade. So young, so strong, so ready for the war, so willing to go and die upon a foreign shore. All march together, everybody looks the same, so there's no one you can blame. Don't be ashamed, light the flame, one more parade. Medals on their coats and guns in their hands, trained to kill as they're trained to stand.
You've been listening to Phil Oakes here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Today is Memorial Day, the traditional holiday to honor all U.S. veterans. President Bush is marking the day by laying a wreath at Arlington National Cemetery, paying special tribute to troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. The U.S. military death toll so far in the invasion and occupation of Iraq is 161. That includes accidental deaths and includes the 40 deaths that have occurred since April 9th, the day the U.S. commanders declared Baghdad liberated. President Bush will also honor fallen heroes at Arlington's Tomb of the Unknown, where President Bush will speak about the sacrifices U.S. troops make. President Bush himself has never served in a war. During the war in Vietnam, Bush avoided being drafted by going into the Texas Air National Guard. Almost no member of Congress has a son or daughter in the military. President Bush has also designated 11 a.m. today in each time zone as a time for Americans to unite in prayer. He said in a Memorial Day proclamation, quote, "Each Memorial Day, we pray for peace throughout the world, remembering what was gained and what was lost during times of war." They are, today on Democracy Now!, we spend the hour with people who are so devout in their belief in peace that they not only pray, but they act. They are the Plowshares activists. For years, they have tried to raise awareness about the brutality of war and how specific warships, weapons, and bases are complicit in the killing of innocent civilians. They derive their name from a line in the book of Isaiah that calls for people to beat their swords into plowshares. The action they took began about 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon when four Catholic workers went aboard the USS Philippine Sea during the 16th annual Fleet Week in New York City. During a tour of the USS Philippine Sea, they poured their blood and hammered on the missile hatches that hold Tomahawk cruise missiles, among others. They held up pictures of Iraqi children who've been injured and maimed by U.S. weapons. Let's take a listen. Four Plowshares activists hammering, having thrown their blood on the deck of the USS Philippine Sea. Just an hour before they had gotten there, the normal tours of the USS Philippine Sea were taking place, and a naval officer explained the significance of this particular warship.
Philippine Sea, I am proud to say we were the first one on station during September 11th and fired the first four missiles at Afghanistan. Every missile hit their target.
The naval officer saying that this ship, the USS Philippine Sea, was the first to attack Afghanistan after September 11th, hitting Afghanistan with four missiles. Well, we're joined in the studio right now by the four protesters who hammered and threw their blood on the warship yesterday. They were arrested, but last night they were released. We'll start with Mark Colville, the New Haven Catholic Worker, and Sister Susan Clarkson of the Dorothy Day Catholic Worker House in Washington, D.C., originally from Britain. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Sister Susan Clarkson, can you talk about why you took the risk that you took yesterday?
Yes, I can. Good morning. A few years ago, I was introduced to the Catholic Worker movement, and I've always been impassioned by the combination of hospitality to the poor and resistance to all war-making and all violence. And I came here to the United States last year, in May of last year, to join the Catholic Worker in D.C. And to, at first, I just thought, oh, I'm just coming to learn about the Catholic Worker. But goodness me, the Spirit of God really took hold of me. And I was learning about the Plowshares movement, which you've spoken about. And gradually, more and more, as time went on, I felt, perhaps I can do this. And it's strange for me because I'm an alien in an alien land, and I'm also legally blind, what's called legally blind in this country. And I thought, I can never do this. But I just felt inspired to join in a process, and we prayed and shared scripture together for many months. And it just came clear to me that I could join in this and take part in this disarmament. I feel very strongly about doing it as a British citizen because I was deeply shamed by Tony Blair's alliance with George Bush. And I know that in Britain people were not happy about that at all. And so this is my take on the special relationship between the United States and Britain. And I'm really proud to have taken part in this yesterday with my American brothers and sister.
Mark Colville, you all four, and this is not always the case with the Plowshares movement, are Catholic workers. Can you explain what that is and what the whole movement is, the Plowshares movement?
Well, the Catholic Worker is a movement that started back in the Depression era, and it's basically a response to the call of the gospel to give hospitality to the poor and the oppressed and those who are injured by the systems and structures of society. We open houses of hospitality throughout the country and also in Britain and other nations. We care for the poor and the homeless. We live in voluntary poverty. We practice nonviolence as a personal lifestyle and as a method for social change. One of the key charisms of the Catholic Worker is not simply to give service to the poor, but also to defend them by nonviolently confronting the war machine.
And the Plowshares movement, in this program, we're going to travel to Ireland to a Plowshares movement that took place recently. Martin Sheen was just in Ireland and gave them a presidential pardon, plays president on television. We're going to speak with two nuns in Baltimore, Ardith Platy and Carol Gilbert, who face very serious sentences for Plowshares action they engaged in. And we'll end by hearing the words of Phil Berrigan, who died this past December, who was one of the founders of the Plowshares movement. But can you put yourself in that movement and how you came to it?
Well, I would say, first of all, responding to what the soldier said at the beginning of this piece, he spoke with pride about four Tomahawk cruise missiles being launched at Afghanistan. And I reflect on the fact that at the beginning of Fleet Week, I went on to the USS Portland for a tour. It's a guided missile cruiser, just like the Philippine Sea. And when we went to the missile hatches, I was questioning the soldier giving the tour about what do these missiles do when they hit the ground. He had no idea. He had no idea what kind of warheads were in the missiles. And so going on to that ship is... the first most immediate concern of mine was to bring the blood that these things shed back so that the people who launched them can see it, and also the people who come onto that ship to tour it in kind of a worship ceremony, can see the blood and the faces of the children who have been killed and maimed by these things. That's the most immediate concern. You know, as a Christian, as a Roman Catholic, it's definitely a call of faith and discipleship for me to practice nonviolence. Again, not only as a personal lifestyle, but nonviolence is not just refusing to kill myself or refusing to kill others myself, but also getting in the way of killing, placing my body between the victims and the victimizers. This was a way of doing that symbolically and concretely. And that's my attraction to the Plowshares movement, is that it's a call, it's a concrete call to peace. And it's a call to the consciences of all of us, not just soldiers, but all of us who are complicit in war making, which includes myself.
Mm-hmm. Looking at the history of this ship, of the USS Philippine Sea, they said, and the tour guide said on the ship yesterday, that it was commissioned in 1989, that it had a tour of duty that included firing 10 Tomahawk cruise missiles during Desert Storm, that it also had been the first to fire on Afghanistan, and was made at Bath Iron Works in Maine. And I know that was a site of another Plowshares action. Mark yes. Colville, were you involved with that one?
Yes, I was. I was one of six people who boarded the USS the Sullivans back in on Ash Wednesday, 1997. And we performed a similar action on that ship. We were subsequently charged by the federal government with destruction of government property and conspiracy. And I served a year of a 13-month sentence for that, and the others also received sentences, some twice as much.
And you chose, was Phil Berrigan a part of
yeah,
that as Phil well?
Yeah, Phil was with us there. And it was a great mentoring experience for me to study and pray and share a jail cell with Phil. He's definitely a great inspiration to all of us, and we reflected before yesterday on how he would be with us there on the ship, and we definitely felt his presence there.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. The other two people who were involved in this action will also join us, and we're going to go down to Jonah House Resistance Community in Baltimore to speak with two nuns who engaged in a similar protest and face a very serious sentence. We'll then go to Ireland, and we will end up with Phil Berrigan himself, his words over the years. You are listening to Democracy Now, and we'll be back in a minute.
Rulers of the nations, as you fuss and fight over who owns this or that and who has the right to design, build, sell and store and fire all the bombs and guns to defend your holy empire. There are children hungry, children sick and dying. There are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers crying. They're only pawns in your play of power and corruption. Slowly starve them, your new weapon of mass destruction. And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand? Is it for freedom or our comfort and convenience? Is it to profit for big business we pledge our allegiance? Are we prisoners in the land of the brave and the bold, held by indifference or hearts grown hard and cold? And prove to me, America, that you care. And prove to me, America, you're aware. Who's dying for your freedom in this land? Who pays the cost for the liberties you demand?
Is it for freedom? Sarah Thompson here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. And this Memorial Day, joined in the studio, we were just speaking with Mark Colville and Sister Susan Clarkson, two Catholic workers. In just a minute, Joan Gregory and Brian Buckley, the other two who were part of the four-person plowshares action that they called Riverside Plowshares by the Riverside yesterday in New York on the USS Philippine Sea, where they hammered and threw their blood on the first warship to attack Afghanistan after September 11th. But we're going to turn now to two Dominican nuns who are awaiting sentencing for another plowshares action. On the morning of October 6, 2002, the Roman Catholic nuns cut the chain securing a nuclear missile site in northeastern Colorado and entered. They hammered on a 110 concrete lid the Minuteman III missile silo. 110-ton concrete lid covering the Minuteman III missile silo. They poured their own blood in the shape of crosses from plastic baby bottles. They sang and they prayed for peace. A Denver jury convicted them last month of injuring and obstructing national defense and of inflicting more than $1,000 of damage to government property. Prosecutors said they'll ask U.S. District Judge Robert Blackburn to sentence the nuns to 5 to 8 years in federal prison and tens of thousands of dollars in fines. We're joined now by Carol Gilbert and Ardeth Platt in Baltimore. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
When did you get out of jail?
We were released from jail on April 30th and spent 2 weeks in Denver speaking, well, not only in Denver, in Colorado, speaking all over the state about the action and what we were facing, and arrived back here in Baltimore on May 13th.
Ardeth, can you talk about the action that you engaged in and why you decided to do this when you knew it was breaking the law?
Well, first of all, Amy, we understand ourselves as doing nonviolent civil resistance, which is actually upholding the law. It's actually trying to stop the lawlessness and the crimes of the government. So we prayed for 9 months and birthed an action based on the President of the United States threatening to use nuclear weapons and projecting that on the axis of evil nations. And when we did this, we went to Colorado because it houses all of the masters in space pursuits, the occupation and exploitation of outer space that's being projected. And then secondly, it has 49 Minuteman missile silos, these missiles on high trigger alert. So we went there to join in the spirit of inspecting the site, of exposing it to the world, to the public, and symbolically disarming, awaiting there to tell the missileers they had no right to commit war crimes if they were commanded to do so. So ours was a resistance action to highlight the fact that nuclear weapons, weapons of mass destruction in the United States, can be found by the hundreds in the farmers' fields of Colorado, Montana, Nebraska, Wyoming, North Dakota, and, of course, on the Trident submarines. And as you experienced yesterday, the nuclear weapon capacity ships that actually have, by the way, used nuclear depleted uranium on these other countries.
We're talking to Ardeth Platt and Carol Gilbert, Dominican nuns who hammered on a missile silo in northeastern Colorado. The sentences you face now, how unusual are they for this kind of act?
Well, we haven't seen these kinds of sentences come down in a very long time, Amy. One of the earlier Plowshares actions in which Helen Woodson, fathers Carl Cabot, and his brother Larry Cloud Morgan were part of at a missile silo did result in 18-year sentences, and those eventually were lowered to 12 and a half. But probably, I would say, almost close to the last 20 years, these kinds of sentences have not come down on people.
Why do you think they're coming down so hard on you right now?
Well, my conviction has been, Amy, that
Ardeth.
The Patriot Bill and all of the signs of the United States government are to prohibit dissent. And what we've tried to communicate to the court, their overcharging of sabotage and depredation that could bring us 30 years in prison, that will not stop the nonviolent civil resistance, that it is impending upon the judicial to hold accountable in the balance of power the executive and the legislative branches who continue to fund wars that massively kill men, women, and children. And this is so barbaric. So what our quest is to continue to speak the truth to these powers, that citizens will assume their right and their duty to symbolically disarm until the actual disarmament takes place. And that's what we're demanding in Iraq, that's what we're demanding in North Korea and the other countries that we claim have bad nuclear weapons. Well, evidently, ours are good nuclear weapons. And each bomb today kills men, women, and children who are totally innocent, who are totally removed from any kind of power, within their own government. So it all has to stop. It all has to be banned.
We're going to turn now as well to Ireland. You committed your Plowshares action last October, Ardeth Platt and Carol Gilbert. In the early hours of Monday, February 3rd, 2003, five members of the pacifist Catholic worker movement cut their way into Shannon Airport in Ireland. The peace activists poured human blood on the runway that's been servicing U.S. military flights, troop and munition deployments to U.S. military bases in Kuwait and Qatar. They constructed a shrine on the runway dedicated to Iraqi children. This was just before the invasion. The five activists were arrested and are now facing 10 years in prison for their nonviolent direct action to protest Ireland's, what they called Ireland's complicity in the Iraqi invasion. The Irish government is charging them with $2 million worth in damages to government property. 50,000 troops passed through the civilian airport on their way to Iraq. Three U.S. airlines transporting U.S. troops and munitions withdrew from Ireland following the Plowshares and other disarmament actions. Martin Sheen traveled to Ireland this past weekend to issue the Pit Stop Plowshares activists a presidential pardon. Sheen plays U.S. president on TV on the program West Wing, interestingly enough, which broadcasts on NBC, which is owned by General Electric, one of the major nuclear weapons manufacturers in the world. But we're joined on the phone right now by Kieran O'Reilly, who is an Irish Australian and one of the five people who were arrested in Ireland at Shannon Airport. Welcome to Democracy Now, Kieran.
Thank you. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you describe your action and why you chose Shannon Airport?
Yeah, our community is quite an interesting one. Damien is from the Midlands, a countryman, and Deirdre is from Dublin. Ewan Dunlop is an Irish-American, myself an Irish-Australian, and Karen Fallon, an Irish-Glaswegian from Scotland. So the three countries we were drawn from the diaspora were all involved in this war along with the United States. We made our way a few days after a solo disarmament action was done on the U.S. Navy warplane that was under repair in a hangar. The repairs had been completed about 6 hours before we managed to access it, and we began to inflesh the prophecy of Isaiah to beat swords into plowshares. This was a major embarrassment for the government, who had declared 2 days earlier that they had learnt from their mistakes and had secured the area. They then deployed the Army and the Navy to secure an airport. And I guess part of what Plowshares does as a prophecy is to expose, to make what is covert overt, and in this case, the militarization of a civilian airport, Shannon Airport, in the western part of the country, had become a pit stop for the U.S. War machine. And the government was very ambiguous about how many troops are going through. The Irish government were not checking the planes and still continue not to check the planes and what they're carrying. A former commandant from the Irish Army, Ed Horgan, took the Irish government to the High Court, and in discovery it was exposed the planes were carrying components for Tomahawk, cruise and Patriot missiles. It was also, Ireland is traditionally a neutral country, and the Constitution demands that Dáil Éireann, or the Parliament, be consulted before any belligerent force or any military force is allowed into the country. And this is on a case-by-case basis, and this was being undermined as well. So we brought our appreciation for the sanctity of human life and the mandate to beat swords into plowshares and to love our enemies, which would imply not being complicit with incinerating their children. And with that energy and motivation, we began to beat the plane and to transform it. And then after doing a certain amount of disarmament, we knelt in prayer. We also built a shrine on the runway composing of Islamic and Christian holy books and prayer beads and photographs of Iraqi children. Part of our action was not in anticipation of a war, but a war that has continued since 1991 with the genocidal sanctions, which the U.S. Navy has been very significant in enforcing at the cost of 1.5 million Iraqi lives.
What was the response of other Irish peace activists? Because I understand that there was a peace encampment that was shut down as a result of your actions.
Well, direct action isn't new to Ireland, but nonviolent direct action is pretty new. And also faith-based direct action is very new to the country. The government, the prosecution of us and the other woman is really being motivated by the U.S. government. So the deployment of the Army and the Navy, the Arianta, the Irish Airlines, taking out high court injunctions on the peace camp, our restrictive bail conditions. I was denied bail on being too passionate to be allowed onto the streets, which is was a surprise to me. That was a problem in Ireland. And now we're on bail and we have to sign on at a specific police station in Dublin every day. We're banned from County Clare, where our court case is to happen, in the most isolated of towns, Kilrush. So the reaction from the government has been very over the top to appease the U.S. government. And the role of Ireland increasingly is like Britain, and that is to sell the U.S. foreign policy to Europe and try to divide any kind of European independent foreign policy. So people who had maintained a peace camp for a month, it began as a weekend peace camp, decided that their resources were exhausted and pretty much closed the camp in response to the High Court injunctions issued by Arianta.
Kieran O'Reilly, you are no stranger to Plowshares actions. You were involved with the ANZUS Plowshares, which what you say, disarmed a B-52 bomber in upstate New York during the Gulf War with Bill and Sue Frankelstreet. And you were a member of the Jabaluka Plowshares in Australia. Can you describe what you did there?
The ANZUS Plowshares, ANZUS from Australia, New Zealand and the United States, where the participants were drawn from, made their way to Griffiths Air Force Base that is now closed down, thanks be to God. And in the early hours of New Year's Day, 91, 2 weeks before the deadline that George Bush Sr. had set for Iraq, were able to disable and disarm a fully nuclear-loaded B-52 bomber on 10-minute scramble alert. And as we found out in the trial, it did not fly for the next 2 months. And unfortunately, other B-52s from that base were deployed to England and did bombing runs daily, dropping napalm, cluster bombs, and fuel air explosives. With the Jabiluka, we were then sentenced to a year in prison, and I did 13 months before getting the more traditional punishment of transportation to Australia. I then went to England in 96 to organise around the Seeds of Hope Plowshares, a group of women who had disarmed a Hawk fighter British Aerospace was selling to the genocidal dictatorship in Indonesia to be used against the people of East Timor. And at that trial, after being accused of £2.5 million British pounds worth of disarmament, a Liverpool jury who had never heard of East Timor before acquitted these four women and basically congratulated them for their action. I returned to Australia and went up to the Aboriginal lands in the Northern Territory, where a second uranium mine, Jabiluka, was under construction. And with Trina Lenthal, we made our way to into the mine and to a huge excavator and were able to disable this huge piece of mining equipment. And we spent, I think, 5 months in Darwin Prison, which was 95% Aboriginal population. And all these experiences, most of my time in the States was in Pecos, Texas, where I was most of the time the only white person, the only first world person in the jail. All those experiences have had an evangelizing effect on me, awakening me to the reality is that these systems of violence or exploitation are basically set up for me, the first world white male. And if I'm to kind of confront that privilege, it leads logically to nonviolent resistance.
In the studio with us, in addition to Mark Colville and Sister Susan Clarkson, who engaged in the Riverside Plowshares yesterday on Sunday, on this Memorial Day weekend in New York on the USS Philippine Sea, Joan Gregory and Brian Buckley, both Catholic workers. Joan, you're 70 years old. Is this your first Plowshares action?
Yes, it is.
What brought you to do this?
I have to. I could not just care for my grown children and perhaps my nieces and nephews' children. I have life within me now, and I must use that life to preserve life.
Were you afraid when you went onto the ship yesterday?
Not. As I was going up the gangplank, I was not afraid. Not at all during the action, which is a complete blessing, I feel. 9 months, I had deep fears, not continually, but they would rise up. But they were more of a transformation within myself, that I was convinced I was doing what I believed in, and the God of my faith set me straight, and this is what I must do. This is the life that I need to use for such to. As each of the people was saying, that there's untruth being sent all over this. The government into the whole world, and the little truth that I see, I must say it.
Brian Buckley, was this your first action?
Yes, first Plowshares action.
How did you prepare for it, and what about the idea that the sailors on board the ship, Democracy Now!, was there filming this action yesterday, one of the rare times that one of these actions is filmed. Years ago, Mike Wallace went to a site and got picked up by the military, and a few years ago, Jeremy Scahill and I went to the Andrews Air Force Base to a military hardware show where there was a Plowshares action.
Right.
The military confiscated all our equipment. In the end, they were forced to apologize for what they had done to us. But it's very rare to get to film one of these actions. Filming you yesterday, we couldn't see the preparations you'd made for this, but your thoughts.
On preparation, yeah, there was a lot of travel involved. We're coming from four different parts of the East Coast and coming from Virginia. And
do you face a trial now?
Actually, we were released on no charges were filed. We were in custody of the Navy and feds, and there was a big mix-up and confusion about who was going to release us. It was the Navy who had arrested us, and so NYPD was about to release us and then pulled us back from the gates and waited for the federal agents to release us. I don't know in whose jurisdiction we now fall under, but officially there have been no charges filed against us. But again, as far as preparation, a lot of prayer. I've been in praying with my community, both the Little Flower Catholic Worker community and friends that I've made in the past couple of years, my brothers.
Well, in this last segment of the show, we're going to bring people the words of Phil Berrigan, who was the first Roman Catholic priest to be imprisoned for political reasons in the United States, first jailed in 1967 for destroying draft files in Baltimore. In 68, he was arrested for burning draft files in Catonsville, Maryland, in a case that became known as the Catonsville Nine, and together with his brother, Father Dan Berrigan, launched the Plowshares movement. Today, we're going to hear an audio collage of Phil Berrigan interviews produced by Pacifica Peace Watch's Scott Gurian and Laurel Padgett Seekins. It features one of the last recorded interviews of Phil Berrigan.
I'm a World War II veteran. I was commissioned as an infantry officer in France in 1944. Because of my involvement in the military for about 3.5 years and my participation in the European theater of operations, I had to slowly unlearn many of the lessons and falsehoods that I had picked up. This took a long and laborious course. I came home and at the behest of my family went to Holy Cross College and then entered the Josephite Seminary in the same year, and after 5 years I was ordained a Catholic priest, and then my true education began, I believe. Our apostolate was to African Americans, and most of our missions and schools were in the Deep South. Black people began to educate me. So I joined the civil rights struggle and became active in the Deep South, in Selma, Alabama, in New Orleans, Montgomery, Alabama, and many other places. Now, from that, I learned about the war in Vietnam and African-American participation in it. While teaching in New Orleans at a black high school, I saw my students recruited by the Air Force and by the Army and Marines and other branches of the service, thinking nothing of it in those days. But nonetheless, the lessons of the civil rights movement struck deeply into me and found a chord of response, especially the nonviolence of Martin Luther King. He, in turn, of course, was highly influenced by the nonviolence of Jesus and by Gandhi. In a very true sense, the civil rights leaders taught me. I became active against the war in about 1962, through legal measures mostly. I did not learn about civil disobedience until the mid-60s. In 1967, while the March on the Pentagon happened, I went with three other friends to the Baltimore Customs House and we poured our blood on 1A draft files. For this, we were indicted, went to trial, while Baltimore and Washington and New York City and other major American cities burned because of the assassination of Martin Luther King in early 1968. I was awaiting sentencing for the Baltimore Customs House action when we drew together, several of us, the Catonsville Nine. And we went to a suburb of Baltimore, and we this time took the 1A files out of the draft boards there and burned them in a parking lot outside.
It was to say our daily bread, but The Cadenceville Nine was one of the defining actions of the movement against the Vietnam War. The image of nine Americans, two of them Catholic priests, burning a pile of over 600 draft files with homemade napalm shocked the country.
For this, I was given a six-year sentence and was denied bail. I went to jail in May of 1968. I was released on bail about Christmas time of 1968 and then began to work solidly against the war, participating with friends in the formation of draft board raiding groups, nonviolent raiding groups, and did this until ordered to surrender in April of 1970. My brother, myself, George Mishy, and Mary Moyland at this point went underground.
While he was underground, Phil made a recording explaining his reasoning for refusing to report to prison. The tape was played on Pacifica Station WBAI in April of 1970.
We have trouble with surrender, even as we have trouble with official notions of crime or justice, because this government refuses to represent the poor or blacks or students. It does not represent us. If it were truly representative, we would not be sent to jail, nor would it suppress our black brothers and sisters and send to battlefield murder or to death our young brothers, and then suck dry for profit's sake our poor brothers here and abroad. And so it becomes a problem to us, as it has to the remainder of the world, placing us all in a common dilemma of survival.
Phil was caught by the FBI after 2 weeks.
I started serving my time at Lewisburg Penitentiary in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania, and was there until August or September of that year when I was switched to Danbury, a federal institution in Danbury, Connecticut, and was there for the next 2.5 to 3 years.
Even after the end of the Vietnam War, Berrigan continued his active resistance to U.S. militarism and nuclear weapons. He estimates he took part in over 100 actions in the next 40 years. In 1980, he, along with 7 others, started the International Plowshares Disarmament Movement when they entered a General Electric plant in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania.
We had friends up in Media, PA, that had been demonstrating at Plant Number 9, General Electric, for about 2 years. So they suggested that the prophecy of Isaiah might be implemented there, and it was a completely new idea to us that we would be expected to take the initiative when the government wasn't willing to do that and beat swords into plowshares, beat nuclear weapons into scrap. We knew nothing about the guts of the plant, what the layout was. In any event, we tried to go in with the workers at about 7 a.m. Two of our number distracted the guard in the vestibule of the plant, and then others filed into the plant proper, and it took us about 10 seconds. Jean Chouchard went into a non-destructible testing room there, and there they were. So we began to work on them immediately, and then it broadened out a bit, and we were pouring blood on classified blueprints, and we were destroying tools that had been specially made to work on the Mark 12A. I think faith has a great deal to do with always finding the weapons and always doing what you intend to do to them, because they're so anti-human, and because the God we try to be faithful to is all about the human. We say God is a God of compassion. We say that these are annihilatory weapons. They're true weapons of mass destruction. And we believe that they're the taproot of violence in the West here, because any people who would make the decision and would learn to love the company of the bomb and its use in certain circumstances against another people are mad. And we still haven't been able to understand, you know, the psychic or the spiritual effect of loving the bomb here in this country. And that's one of the things you free yourself of when you do a plowshares action. You no longer love the bomb. You've taken some measures against it. Yet you're saying, look, I won't pay for it. I won't work on it. See, I won't feed it with my silence. I won't remain passive while it exists. You're saying all of those things, and you're liberating yourself from that bomb.
Philip Berrigan married Liz McAllister, and together they started Jonah House, a Catholic community in Baltimore, Maryland, dedicated to resisting nuclear weapons.
It's a nonviolent, very simply, a nonviolent resistance community. We don't say one of our priorities is serving the poor, though we do an awful lot of work in behalf of the poor. We hold all things in common. We practice voluntary poverty. We work with our hands to earn what we need for our living and our work. And that means supporting any effort towards resistance and peace. And it's been that way now since 1973. The community has paid quite a sizable price, not only in actions, but also in jail time. We speak of a revolving door between prison and what we call minimum security, which is living in this society.
Along with community, Phil saw the need for a deeply committed peace movement.
You know, you don't build a movement without people. You don't have a movement unless essential education, both moral and political, of a very, very high quality is extended. Building a movement or building a revolution is essentially a community operation, as I see it. So there again, I would focus on a politics that would build a movement, because it would influence people, bring them to a higher level of consciousness and a higher degree of risk in their lives, realizing that their identity is impossible unless they take risks for their brothers.
In one of the last interviews he gave, Phil was optimistic about the growing movement against the possible U.S. war on Iraq.
I'm very, very, very hopeful. Very hopeful. Because, you know, we all experienced 9/11, and we did realize the plurality that Bush had by way of support, and we did see the country go crazy with flags and all of that. Well, now a lot of that is being taken back, and people are beginning to, in a very sobering and responsible way, they're beginning to rock back on their heels and say, there's something fishy about this. And of course, the fishiest thing is the war on terrorism, which is a big swindle. It's not a war on terrorism at all. A war on terrorism by the United States is impossible, because we're the number one terrorists. It's impossible, absolutely impossible.
As we hold up Philip Berrigan, we mustn't leave out the many who accompanied him on his journey. The folks who went to prison with him, the many who've been a part of the Jonah House community, his partner Liz McAllister, and their three children who know all too well the challenges of a life of resistance. As he passes, may his vision and life assist us in finding our own paths to creating a nonviolent world.
And all my country saw were priests who broke the law. First it was a question, then it was a mission, how to be American.
Remembering Phil Berrigan, produced by Scott Gurian and Laurel Padgett-Seekins of Pacificus Peace Watch. And that does it for the program. If you'd like to get a video or audio copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Sharif Abdel-Kaddous, Elizabeth Press. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website, www.democracynow.org, where we video and audio stream. Our email address, mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This film is about the involvement of U.S. Special Forces in the murder and disappearance of up to 3,000 Taliban prisoners who'd given themselves up under guarantee their lives would be spared. If people think Afghanistan has been liberated, then they have to be kidding themselves. The warlords are more powerful today than they've ever been, and freedom at the end of a Kalashnikov is no freedom at all.
Today, part two of our series on the controversial film Afghan Massacre, The Convoy of Death, which Democracy Now! Premiered nationally on Friday. We talk to award-winning filmmaker Jamie Duran about his film's explosive evidence that U.S. troops are guilty of war crimes in Afghanistan and the current state of the war-torn country. All that and more coming up. Ready? Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Outrage is mounting in New York following the death of Usman Zango, gunned down by police on Thursday in a scenario strikingly similar to that of Amadou Diallo. Both came to New York from West Africa in search of a better life. Both were shot dead by police. Both were unarmed. Both had no criminal record. The 43-year-old Usman Zango fixed African artifacts for a living in the Chelsea section of Manhattan. He worked in the same building where another company illegally distributed bootleg compact discs. Police raided the building on Thursday to stop the selling of the uncopyrighted recordings. Zango was working nearby when he encountered 25-year-old Officer Brian Conroy. Police said Zango approached Conroy, who was wearing plain clothes. For some reason, a chase ensued that ended when Zango ran into a dead end. Conroy then shot him 5 times. Zango suffered wounds to the abdomen, chest, upper back, and was grazed on the right arm. Conroy told officers at the scene that Zango reached for his gun, but there were no witnesses to confirm this. At a rally on Saturday, the Reverend Al Sharpton said the shooting was unjustified. He said, quote, "I don't know any unarmed man who would pick a fight with a police officer." The shooting came less than a week after the New York police mistakenly raided the Harlem apartment of Alberta Sproul and came just a few days before Alberta Sproul was buried herself. Police burst into her apartment at 6 in the morning, exploded a flash grenade, handcuffed the 57-year-old city employee. Then they realized they had the wrong apartment. She died of a heart attack a few hours later. On Saturday, Alberta Sproul was buried following a funeral that attracted over 3,000 mourners. At the funeral, Mayor Michael Bloomberg said, "As mayor, I failed to protect someone I was chosen to work with. We all failed. Humanity, an innocent human being, was taken from us, and our actions caused it." Bloomberg was praised for publicly apologizing, but many remained skeptical. Civil rights attorney Norman Siegel said, "Words are easy. Actions and changes are the real test." For the first time in its history, the Israeli government has accepted the creation of a Palestinian state. On Sunday, by one vote more than the majority needed, Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon's cabinet approved steps set out in the U.S. so-called roadmap to peace. But the Washington Post points out the Israeli cabinet avoided saying that it accepted the roadmap itself. President Bush is expected to travel to the region next month for discussions with the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers, Ariel Sharon and Mahmoud Abbas. Israeli officials said U.S. pressure played a major role in the vote. Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert told Israel Radio, "I think the document is not a good one, but we have to choose when we battle the U.S., and now is not the time." The Guardian of London reports General Sharon told his cabinet he was not happy with the roadmap, but it was, quote, "the best alternative available." Meanwhile, the BBC reports Israeli forces today blew up 2 West Bank homes, killing 7 people. The London Observer is reporting the U.S. illegally is holding up to 3,000 Iraqi prisoners of war in Iraq. In violation of the Geneva Convention, human rights officials and the Red Cross have been denied access to the captives. A French television cameraman who was wrongly arrested and briefly detained got a rare glimpse inside the prison. He said he saw hundreds of men hooded with their arms tied behind their backs. No Iraqis have yet been released from the compound. The prison camp, located near the Baghdad airport, also contains hundreds of civilians who were detained for looting. A mutiny occurred at the beginning of last week at the camp. The U.S. military officials told The Observer the U.S., quote, dealt with the rebellion. He did not confirm or deny any Iraqis were killed. First it was Iraq, now Iran. The Washington Post is reporting the Bush administration appears set to call for the destabilization of the Iranian government. The Pentagon is urging President Bush to approve public and private actions that could lead to the toppling of the government. Senior Bush administration officials are scheduled to meet tomorrow at the White House to discuss the future of Iran, which has been accused of housing al-Qaeda leaders who played a part in the Saudi Arabian car bombings. The Guardian of London reports the British government opposes any move toward regime change in Iran. The Bush administration is reportedly pressing the International Atomic Energy Agency to issue a critical report next month on Iran's nuclear activities. The Pentagon plan may involve the Iraq-based armed opposition movement Mojahideen Khalq, even though it is designated a terrorist group by the State Department. This news from Afghanistan. Some 200 people threw rocks and cement at the U.S. Embassy this weekend and attacked international peacekeepers in a protest sparked by the killing of three Afghan soldiers last week by U.S. Marines. The Marines mistook the Afghans for enemy combatants and opened fire. The Washington Post is revealing that the New York Times top reporter on bioterrorism, Judith Miller, acknowledged to her colleagues that her main source for many of her articles has been Ahmed Chalabi, the controversial exile leader who is close to top Pentagon officials. In a column in today's paper, Washington Post media critic Howard Kurtz asks, could Chalabi have been using the Times to build a drumbeat that Iraq was hiding weapons of mass destruction? Miller's reliance on Chalabi was revealed after the Post obtained email correspondence between Miller and the Times' Baghdad bureau chief, John Burns. Miller has drawn criticism for her reporting on the hunt for Iraqi weapons while she was embedded with the MET Alpha unit. In an April 21st front-page story, she reported that a leading Iraqi scientist claimed Iraq had destroyed chemical and biological weapons days before the war began. This according to the Alpha team. In that story, she acknowledged that military officials had delayed the publication of the article and that the text of the article was submitted for approval by the military. Since then, the Washington Post reports no evidence has surfaced to support these claims, and the Alpha team is preparing to leave Iraq without having found weapons of mass destruction. And in other news from Iraq, the U.S.-run Iraqi administration has canceled or suspended three oil contracts with Russian and Chinese firms signed by the ousted government of Saddam Hussein. The U.S.-appointed Iraqi oil minister, Thamir Ghadban, said on Saturday all pre-war contracts will be reevaluated and the new deals announced soon. And Indonesia's military said today it is stepping up attacks against Aceh separatist guerrillas a week after the start of its biggest offensive for a quarter of a century. This according to Agence France-Presse. Officials said last week that the Indonesian military is also preparing tented camps to house up to 60,000 civilians who might be moved or relocated out of combat zones. And this news just in. An airplane carrying 62 Spanish peacekeeping troops returning from Afghanistan has crashed into a mountain in Turkey. The plane was attempting to land in thick fog. All 74 people aboard were killed.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. But I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around.
Change is gonna come, Sam Cooke, in response to a listener request on our website at www.democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Friday, we premiered the controversial film, Afghan Massacre, The Convoy of Death. Today, part two, a discussion with the filmmaker. This is a film that has already been broadcast on national television in Britain, Germany, Italy, and Australia. Parts have been screened by the European Parliament, but until we broadcast the film last Friday, it had not been shown nationally in the United States. Afghan Massacre, The Convoy of Death, provides eyewitness testimony that U.S. troops were complicit in the massacre of thousands of Taliban prisoners during the Afghan War. The film tells the story of thousands of prisoners who surrendered to the U.S. military's Afghan allies after the siege of Kunduz. According to eyewitnesses, some 3,000 of the prisoners were forced into sealed containers and loaded onto trucks for transport to Shebrakhan prison. Witnesses say when the prisoners began shouting for air, the U.S. allied Afghan soldiers fired directly into the trucks, killing many of them. The rest suffered through an appalling road trip lasting up to 4 days. So thirsty, they clawed at the skin of their fellow prisoners as they licked perspiration and even drank blood from open wounds. Eyewitnesses say when the trucks arrived and soldiers opened the containers, most of the people inside were dead. They also say U.S. Special Forces redirected the containers carrying the living and dead into the desert and stood by as survivors were shot and buried. Now up to 3,000 bodies lie buried in a mass grave. The film also provides footage of CIA officer Mike Spam interrogating American Taliban prisoner John Walker Lynn just hours before Spam was killed in the famous prison uprising of Mazar-e Sharif. The film has outraged human rights groups and international human rights lawyers who are calling for an investigation into whether U.S. Special Forces are guilty of war crimes. Today, part two of our series. In a minute, we speak to the film's director and producer, Jamie Duran. But first, we play an excerpt of the film. This is how it begins.
After the bloodiest battle of the entire Afghan war, 8,000 Taliban soldiers surrendered to the Northern Alliance and U.S. Special Forces under guarantee that their lives would be spared. Today, up to 3,000 of those men lie in an unmarked desert grave, and American soldiers stand accused by numerous eyewitnesses of being involved in their disappearance.
I think the scale of it, if you talk about thousands of bodies and a cover-up of those bodies, is comparable to thousands of bodies in New York. Now, that is very striking to me, and that's why I think this one will not go away.
An excerpt of Afghan Massacre, The Convoy of Death. We're joined right now by Jamie Duran, the award-winning filmmaker who's worked in the highest levels of television film production for more than two decades. His films have been broadcast everywhere around the world, virtually every major channel. On average, each of his films has been seen in around 35 countries. This film did not get the same attention, at least in this country. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Well, on Friday, we played the documentary, and we got tremendous response to it. Today, we want to play excerpts and talk to you. Lay out the thesis of the film, as you start to do in the beginning that we just played.
Well, effectively, what happened was that 8,000 prisoners, Kunduz was under siege at the time from Northern Alliance soldiers and their American allies. And 8,000 soldiers surrendered after heavy negotiations between the Northern Alliance and the Taliban, but those negotiations actually included American and British military personnel. These negotiations actually took place at Kalajangi, where John Walker Lind had been held, the American Taliban. And the agreement took place whereby if they surrendered, their lives would be spared. That was absolutely straightforward. The majority were expected to be handed over to the United Nations. Instead, of course, there was, if you like, a subplot to this, and quite an essential one militarily, and I can understand it, and that was that the Americans needed to identify who was actually surrendering. Were they Taliban? Were they Al-Qaeda? And the decision was taken to effectively ship these prisoners to a place called Shebahan Prison, far to the west of Mazar-e-Sharif. Now, initially, about 470-odd, including John Walker Lind, broke off and went to Mazar, where that famous battle took place, which I'm sure everyone has seen. What I found terribly unfortunate, and one of the reasons I became involved, was that no one seemed to ask. The international press were completely obsessed with this battle at Kalajangi near Mazar, and no one seemed to bother asking, so what happened to the other 7,500? And this became effectively my task, to find out what happened there. I was drawn to it by speaking to two different groups of soldiers, one of General Dostum, who was America's greatest ally during the war, and the others of Muhammad Atta, who is one of the controllers around Mazar-e-Sharif. Both groups told me separately stories of American soldiers breaking the necks of Taliban prisoners. Now, I obviously found this an interesting suggestion, particularly when it came from two different groupings. Anyone who understands Afghanistan at all, and I'm sure many of your listeners will understand that, you know, Uzbeks do not exactly go out to dinner with Hazaras, who would rather kill Pashtun before they had, tea with the Tajiks. And so the strength of my witnesses in this film very much depends on the ethnicity of it all, the different ethnic backgrounds. James C. Hathaway, the professor of law at international law at the University of Michigan, praised the film recently, talking of the difference in the kind of military and civilian background of my witnesses. What he didn't get into, which adds, of course, far greater force, is the ethnic background. These men come from all different regions and different ethnic groups. And they told me the story of how these prisoners, these prisoners were transported initially by truck to a place called Kali Zaini, which is just on the outskirts of Mazar. This was a kind of holding depot where they were then taken off the trucks, and these were open-back trucks at first. And then initially, after more trucks were brought in, the first ones, the lucky ones, were then taken on to Shebahan Prison. Now, you have to understand this was a prison built to hold between 500 and 600 at most. And by the time 3,000 had arrived, obviously, the prison was rather full. But also, at that time, the news had come through from Kalajangi about the great battle. This is the Mazar battle. And Dostum had lost a good number of his generals and quite a good number of his men. And revenge was in the air. So effectively, the last, if you like, now remember, I've always said only up to 3,000. And normally I've said between 1,500 and 3,000. Even the UN privately will agree that it's 2,000 to 2,500 in the graves that I discovered alone. But normally up to 3,000, between 1,500 and 3,000 is my call. It could actually be more than that, because 4,500 effectively are actually missing. What happened to them, some of them, several hundreds, were handed over to the security services of the various governments. They were actually sold. It's a great Afghan tradition, Afghan warlord tradition, where, you know, if you like, Uzbeks were sold back to the very feared SNB security police in Uzbekistan. The Chechens were handed over to the Russians, etc., etc. But even taking into those numbers, which I believe may go to several hundreds, we're still talking around 3,500 or more people who were then put into these containers. Containers brought in 25 in total at the time, I understand. They were crammed 200 to 300 at a time into the containers. The doors were then sealed. The men had no air at all, and were then they then began this journey from Khali Zaini to Shebahan. It's a distance of only 120 kilometers, but in some cases that journey took up to 4 days because of the queue at Shebahan prison, because the American soldiers who had established a presence there, special forces, they'd established a presence there, and CIA, I should add, they'd established a presence there to identify the prisoners, and thus those in the containers who were stuck outside Shebahan had to wait. And as you know, as you've given us in your intro, when they'd cried out for air, there was a simple answer from the Northern Alliance soldiers, including one of my witnesses who admits himself to firing Kalashnikov into the sides of the containers, killing those nearest the sides, in order to, you know, this kind of bizarre humanitarian effort to give them air. It was a pretty shocking story.
We're talking to Jamie Duran. He is the filmmaker who produced Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. And we'll come back with him as well as excerpts of his film after this break. Stay with us.
I'm just an American boy, raised on MTV, and seen all the kids in the soda pop bands, but none of them look like me. So I started looking around for a light out of the dim. And the first thing I heard that made sense was the word of Muhammad, peace be upon him. I shall do Haila. God, if my daddy could see me now. Chains around my feet, he don't understand. Sometimes a man's got to fight for what he believes, and I believe God is great.
John Walker's Blues here on Democracy Now!, that by Steve Earle. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're going to talk about John Walker Lynn and Johnny Spann in a minute. Some amazing footage that I don't think has been shown in this country of the two at Mazar-e Sharif. But before we do that, we are going to play another excerpt of Jamie Duran's film, Afghan Massacre, the Convoy of Death, talking about the prisoners who had given themselves up, who are now being transported in trucks to Shebahan prison.
In a coordinated operation, truck drivers from all over the region had their vehicles commandeered by armed soldiers. Containers were loaded onto the back of the flatbeds, and the drivers compelled to take their vehicles to Khali Zaini.
We were coming in from Mazar when they seized our trucks for free and took us to Khali Zaini, where there were already a lot of trucks. At about 2 a.m., they loaded our trucks with the prisoners. We were to the north of Khali Zaini, where we loaded the trucks.
Okay.
originally loaded onto trucks at Kunduz. Many of these men were crammed 200 to 300 at a time into the backs of sealed containers. After around 20 minutes, the prisoners began crying out for air. The weather was very hot. They put too many people inside the containers. Many died because there was no air.
Another eyewitness has asked how many containers were at Kali Zaini when he left.
There were about 25 containers. The condition of them was very bad because the prisoners couldn't breathe. So they shot into the containers and some of them were killed.
Another eyewitness.
They told us to stop the trucks and we came down. After that, they shot into the containers. Blood came pouring out of the containers. They were screaming
inside. One Afghan soldier admits that he personally murdered prisoners.
I hit the containers with bullets to make holes for ventilation, and some of them were killed.
You specifically shot holes into the containers. Who gave you those orders?
My commanders ordered me to hit the containers for ventilation, and because of that, some prisoners died.
But this was no humanitarian gesture. Rather than shooting into the roofs of the containers, the soldiers fired at random, killing those nearest the walls. A local taxi driver had called in at a petrol station on the road to Shibarhan.
I smelled something strange and asked the attendant where the smell was coming from. He said, "Look behind you." There were three trucks with containers fixed on them. Blood was running from the containers. My hair stood on end. It was horrific.
Whether or not the prisoners in the containers were ever really destined to reach Shibarhan must be open to question.
Jamie Duran narrating his film Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. Here on Democracy Now!, joined by Jamie Duran on the telephone from Britain. And Jamie, as we listen to this horrific account, I'm looking at a Newsweek piece that was published last August, August 26th. And it says, witness reports and the probing of a mass grave point to war crimes. Does the United States have any responsibility for the atrocities of its allies? A Newsweek investigation. And this came just after you aired excerpts of this documentary for the European Parliament. It says, trudging over the moonscape of Dasht e Laili, a desolate expanse of low-rolling hills in northern Afghanistan, Bill Haglund spotted clues half buried in the gray-beige sand, strings of prayer beads, a woolen skullcap, a few shoes. Those remnants, along with track marks and blade scrapes left by a bulldozer, suggested that Haglund had found what he was looking for. Then he came across a human tibia, three sets of pelvic bones, and some ribs. It says, mass graves are not always easy to spot, though trained investigators know the signs. Says Haglund, a forensic anthropologist and pioneer in the field of human rights archaeology, you look for disturbance of the earth, differences in the vegetation, areas that have been machined over. The piece goes on from there and talks about how many are buried at Dasht e Laili, and it says the dead at Dasht e Laili and the horrific manner of their killing are one of the dirty little secrets of the Afghan war. The episode is more than just another atrocity in a land that has seen many. The killings illustrate the problems America will face if it opts to fight wars by proxy, as the United States did in Afghanistan, using small numbers of U.S. special forces, calling in air power to support local fighters on the ground. It also raises questions about the responsibility Americans have for the conduct of allies who may have no interest in applying protections of the Geneva Conventions. And then in the next paragraph, it says, nothing that Newsweek learned suggests that American forces had advanced knowledge of the killings, witnessed the prisoners being stuffed into the unventilated trucks, or were in a position to prevent that. They were in the area of the prison at the time the containers were delivered, although probably not when they were opened. It says the small group of security forces soldiers were more focused at the time on prison security and preventing an uprising, such as the bloody outbreak that had happened days earlier in the prison at Kalajangi. Your response?
Well, I mean, my response would take most of your program and most of your day. Frankly, the Newsweek piece was a whitewash of the worst degree, as indeed if you speak privately, perhaps to some of the authors you might discover. I honestly, Amy, don't know where to start. You should know that Newsweek, after my showing of a short clip of my film at the European Parliament, Newsweek approached me, and Roy Gutman indeed admitted at a meeting at the American University in Washington in January, in front of 300-400 people, whatever, I can't remember, he admitted that Newsweek's initial interest in the story had been brought about because of my showing of the film at the European Parliament. They then came and interviewed me at length, went off, did their own investigation, and came back and actually called me in the week before publication for my final quotes. Strangely, when the piece actually appeared, no mention of myself, which doesn't matter, I have a big enough ego anyway, no mention of our research, but strangely, if you take a look carefully at the Newsweek article, it seems to be two stories. It has a beginning, no middle, but an end. And I wonder, and I've always wondered, what was in the middle. I think, basically, the idea of any publication suggesting that American forces were not directly involved is not just nonsense, but it's an insult to the incredibly brave witnesses who came forward in my film. Now, maybe Newsweek weren't able to do this. I don't know the caliber of their journalists, frankly. Maybe they weren't able to find these witnesses. What I found fascinating was that after the meeting in Washington, Roy Gutman, having admitted that they began the film only because, or began their story only because of my film, and having tried to defend Newsweek's position, then called me up and said, "Jamie, I didn't realize how much information you have. Can I get a copy of the film?" To which I abruptly, you can understand, said no. I'd seen Newsweek's treatments already. You have to understand, and I'm sure you'll be bringing this up, two of these incredibly brave men, these witnesses in my film, have already been murdered by General Dostum's people. General Dostum, remember, was America's greatest ally during the war. To insult these men's memory by suggesting the Americans were not just involved, but also in command and control at Shebarhan prison for the very purpose of identifying Al-Qaeda and Taliban is beyond understanding. You can probably hear a little shake in my voice. It's a shake of anger that people could actually go ahead and publish such an article and not do a proper, thorough investigation. The Pentagon knows that its people were involved. The State Department knows that the military were involved. They tried everything they could to damn me. And incidentally, the film has been seen in well over 20, maybe as many as 30 countries now. It was offered to many stations in the U.S. who rejected it. Now, remember, I know, I'm pretty long in the tooth, and I know many of the guys, many of the people involved in American television. And the answer I was effectively getting was, "Not now, Jamie." You know, it's kind of post 9/11, pre-Iraq, post-Iraq. It's all this thing. It's control of another kind coming out of the Pentagon. Again, perhaps an interesting aside is that a journalist tried to follow this up, an American journalist who's quite frequently published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, etc., etc. And she found it strange that no one seemed to want to cover this story. So she called up Larry Schwartz at the State Department. I'm sure most of your listeners know and have seen Larry Schwartz on many occasions. And she said to him, "You know, Larry, I can't understand why, you know, there's a couple of small newspapers taking this story, but why won't the majors? Why won't the nationals?" And Larry said, and I quote directly, "You have to understand we're involved, we're in touch with the nationals on a daily basis. This story just won't run, even if it's true." Now, that seems to me the most clear comment on the freedom of the American media at the moment.
We're talking to Jamie Duran. His film is Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. We thought we'd play another excerpt of your film. The part where you talk about U.S. military involvement, which, of course, is throughout the documentary. This one emphasizes it. We're playing excerpts of the film that we premiered on Friday so that we can talk about it piece by piece. Extraordinary allegations of the film team. And in a little while, we're also going to talk about the Afghan researcher who worked with you and what happened to him as he tried to get the final videotapes. This is another excerpt of Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death.
If American soldiers were involved in covering up their role at Shebarhan prison, it would border on war crimes. If they stood by as the summary execution of prisoners took place when they could have intervened, this would be positively criminal. But could the United States argue they were not in a responsible position?
They would not have taken orders from Afghans. They would have been in charge of security there, therefore it is an American command, therefore it is ultimately an American responsibility for whatever went on under the eyes of those American soldiers.
That was analyst Robert Fox.
It's quite clear that because you have film evidence of a mass grave, people confessing that the relevant authorities, be they American, Afghani, or international, must carry out an investigation. You have identified the site of a mass grave. You've identified bodies in those graves, and it's quite clear again that pathologists, forensic pathologists, exhuming the bodies, could identify the cause of death, and I think very importantly, could identify who these people are, because their families had a right to know. They have been disappeared involuntarily after being murdered.
Lawyer Andrew McEntee.
Late September 2002, just over a year after the murder of over 3,000 Americans by Al-Qaeda, human rights expert Andrew McEntee arrives at the scene of another massacre, this time said to involve U.S. special forces.
I understand from very good sources in international organizations, together with the witnesses, that we're certainly talking at 2,000 upwards here, 2,000 to 2,500 in this area.
Is this from a reliable source, an official source?
Yes, I'm not at liberty to say who, but I can tell you it's a very reliable source, which has not yet gone public.
The grave covers an area well in excess of 1,000 square metres.
Everything I've seen here is consistent with testimonies I've heard and read. There seems to be a large area where there's at least... There are several pits here which clearly have bodies in them, clothing. Bullets are consistent with shootings beside the graves. And there are bullets all over the place, cases of bullets. And somebody's been a bit clumsy in removing the evidence. The Americans couldn't have been kept out of the fact there was a major industrial operation with the excavation going on here and containers coming in, the area closed off for a couple of days. They couldn't have been kept out of that. Having effective command and control does mean they were senior in the chain of command. With knowledge, or presuming they had knowledge of what was going on, yes, they had a responsibility to stop it.
General Dostum has said recently that he would agree to an international investigation. But there's a small problem. He says he can't guarantee the safety of those involved.
We have...
That was General Dostum being referred to by Jamie Duran in this film, Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. Tell us a little more about the Afghan general and his relationship with the U.S. Special Forces, Jamie.
Well, I mean, Dostum is a fascinating character. I met him on quite a number of occasions. I think I managed to conduct the only sit-down televised interviews with him because he was always on the move. I was actually with him as we were kind of charging into Taliban villages in a clear-up operation. He is a fascinating character. He's a very large man, physically a very large man. And indeed, speaking to him, I think I remember my first question, which I didn't know if I would get an answer or I'd be, you know, 6 feet under, was, General Dostum, you're known throughout the Western world as a cold-blooded mass murderer. Do you think that's fair? It was fairly direct, but the man... is a very strong character and indeed answered it in the end, basically saying that, you know, people can say what they want, but my people know I'm a good guy.
But it is Dostum's men who carried this out, and in terms of international criminal law, and I don't know about his direct involvement, but certainly I do know that his chief commander, a man known as the Lal Commander, was very much the man behind all of this, his chief military commander. The Americans saw Dostum. I think Richard Pearl in the film says we'd rather have had Mother Teresa, but effectively she wasn't available, so we settled for General Dostum. Dostum is known as a very, very violent character. He's a man who stood by as one of his own men was strapped to the tracks of a tank for disloyalty and apparently lectured him personally as the tank edged forward, you know, inched forward. He's also a man who has apparently boasted about biting the throats out of four different men. This was the man that America chose to make its ally, its chief ally during the war. He is a brilliant military strategist. There's no question about it. And he was the man who, more than anyone else, caused the defeat of the Taliban. I was in the Kokchar region with Fahim's Northern Alliance at the time, and they were actually sitting, waiting. And I was told by the local commander, a man known as Mamur Hassan, that everyone is waiting for Dostum to take Mazar. When Dostum takes Mazar, the Taliban will be so frightened of him moving forward, they will cave in. And indeed, that's exactly what they did.
Jamie, we have to break. We'll come back with you describing the footage you air of Johnny Spann and John Walker Lynn that I think was shocking to many people who got to watch and hear this past Friday. And then we're going to talk about the Afghan researcher who tried to get the final videotape and what would be Dostum's interest in having these videotapes made of these horrific war crimes that he is deeply involved with, why he's having them documented. You're listening to Democracy Now! We're talking with Jamie Duran, the filmmaker who did Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. Stay with us.
Chains around my feet. You don't understand that sometimes a man's got to fight for what he believes. And I believe God is great. All praise due to him. And if I should die, I rise up to the sky just like Jesus. Peace be upon him. I shall do la ilaha illa. There's no God but God.
The controversial song John Walker's Blues by Steve Earle here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with the film Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. The next excerpt we're going to play, you hear CIA officer Mike Spann interrogating the American Taliban prisoner John Walker Lynn shortly before Spann was killed in the famous prison uprising. Now, it is not easy to hear. This is video. It's a little easier, perhaps, to hear there. Lynn is kneeling on the ground with his arms tied behind his back. Two CIA officers are standing right in front of him. The CIA agents are saying to each other, the problem is he needs to decide if he wants to live or die. I mean, if he don't want to die here, he's going to die here because we're just going to leave him and he's going to stay in prison for the rest of his life. Short life. It's his decision. We can only help those guys who want to talk to us. We can only get the Red Cross to help so many guys. That's within this excerpt of Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death.
Kalai Jungi, a giant mud brick fort on the outskirts of Mazar, which Dostum made his military headquarters after capturing the city.
a section of the main building was made available to American Special Forces and CIA personnel who had arrived to interrogate the prisoners.
These men are dead. These men are dead.
The Taliban were housed in this block before being taken out one by one and made to sit in long lines across the fort interior, their arms tied behind their backs. Chechens, Arabs, Pakistanis and Uzbeks. Only a few were Afghans. Amongst the prisoners was John Walker Lind, the American Taliban, who attempted to conceal his identity from two CIA officers.
Well, obviously it is. The problem is he needs to decide if he wants to live or die, and die here. I mean, if he don't want to die here, he's going to die here, because this is where we're just going to leave, and they're going to put him in prison the rest of his fucking, you know, short life. It's his decision, man. We can only help those guys who want to talk to us. We can only get the Red Cross to help so many guys. If they don't talk to us, we can't.
Just an hour or so after these pictures were taken, one of them, Mike Spern, would be dead following an uprising amongst the prisoners.
That, another excerpt from Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. Jamie Duran, filmmaker, can you describe this footage and how you got it? The only footage that I remember seeing of John Walker Lynn was the picture of him laying with his face darkened.
Yeah, basically I got this footage by paying dollars. That's the bottom line. There was a fascination in northern Afghanistan around that time and probably since, of people, you know, you have to understand this nation had very few modern things. And one of the real fascinations came around video cameras. And this particular one, I think, was shot in an old VHS camera. And basically, I paid some dollars. What actually happened was that the cameraman had managed to get inside the compound. This is prior to the riots, to the revolt. And he'd got inside the compound and was filming. I'm certain didn't have a single clue as to what the CIA fellows were actually saying to Lind, but, you know, managed to actually just pick up this footage, which we then managed to decipher and play out. It was just one of the fascinating things is that, of course, as a result of our film going out in the European Parliament, I was then approached by Lind's own personal investigators, who came over to see me in London. Now, they were obviously fighting to defend Lind. And he then headed over to Afghanistan and came back to see me on the way back. And he'd gone to film Lind's exact position in the hills, certain hills, as I'll explain. And he showed me the footage showing how, you know, and Lind's main defense at the time was that he, although he'd carried a rifle or a gun, he'd never ever fired it, nor had he seen any activity whatsoever, any violent or warlike activity of any kind. At which point I then asked my cameraman from who was with me in Afghanistan to come back into the room where I was viewing this. And I didn't say a word, and I just asked Barry, Lynn's investigator, to run the footage back and let us see it again, and let Mark, my cameraman, see it. And Mark watched it and then said, and I think I can, I'll keep my words fairly gentle, avoiding the expletives, by saying, "Good Lord, that's where they were shooting at us from." This was John Walker Lind's exact position. 4 days later, Lind agreed a plea bargain with the U.S.
Say that one more time.
4 days after, Barry had come to us and we had identified that that was where we were being shot upon. We were actually in the trenches below Lind's position. And indeed, Lind effectively was lying. He had actually been involved in an area of fighting without any question. I'm not saying he fired the bullets, but to suggest that he'd not been involved at all was nonsense. 4 days after, Barry discovered that Lind had actually been, let's just say, not telling the full truth. They agreed a plea bargain with the U.S. government. That's when Lind got 20 years.
Dostum, who still has tens of thousands of dollars worth of your equipment, but to say the least, that's the least of what he has done. Can you talk about why you think he may be involved? And we're going to play a big excerpt of your researcher and what happened to him. Do you believe Dostum had the tapes made of the massacre to protect himself?
I think you have to understand that General Dostum, General Dostum has three cameramen who kind of shoot everything. They were shooting in the hills in the initial battles, long before the full involvement. This was just after the American Special Forces had joined up with him. I have footage of Dostum in the hills with the U.S. Special Forces actually beginning the campaign against the Taliban. Why does he have this particular footage? His cameraman shoots everything in sight. Two, it's the best insurance policy I could possibly imagine, because let's face it, if Dostum is accused of war crimes, he will then be able to show this footage and say, but hang on, it wasn't just me. There were other people there. For instance, here's some footage of American Special Forces standing by as men are massacred.
Well, let's go to the excerpt of the documentary where you describe what happened to your researcher, the award-winning journalist Najibullah Qureshi, who is Afghan, as he tried to get the last video documentary evidence of the massacre site. This is Afghan Massacre Convoy of Death.
Security in northern Afghanistan is a virtually impossible concept to grasp, particularly when you're investigating the very people who hold all the cards. Our local researcher, Najibullah Qureshi, had managed to access damning footage of events at Kali Zaini, Shibar Khan, and Dashti Laili. He had been shown a tape of 1.5 hours in length, which included film of Dostum's soldiers shooting into the containers, American personnel surrounding those same containers as the bodies were dragged off at Shibar Khan, and crucially, pictures of the summary executions at Dashti Laili, with U.S. Special Forces standing by, doing nothing to intervene. A price was agreed, and Najibullah left Mazar for the handover. We could only wait. As the day wore on, we became concerned.
I had taken a VCR with me to copy the film. I rewound it to the beginning and started making the copy. I only managed to record 1.5 minutes during the time on the film when they were loading the Taliban onto the containers. They were opening and loading them onto containers, and then they started shooting into the containers. Just then, a fat man entered the room. There were three people, one of whom was armed. The person who was giving me the film told me, quote, "This is my brother." His brother swore at him and said he told him not to give the film to anyone. Quote, "Why have you given him the film?" he asked. Then they started beating us. They hit my head a lot at the beginning. After that, I fell unconscious.
Drifting in and out of consciousness, he remembers being driven in a car, his captors apparently planning to dispose of his body.
One of them was saying, quote, "There's a well around here." They stopped the car and took me out. Then another car arrived, but they started beating me again. After that, I don't know what happened. I woke up and I was home.
Although nothing can be certain, it appears that the people in the other car knew Najibullah and managed to save his life, despite his captors giving him a final beating.
There was some very interesting and dangerous footage on the film.
Could this film be General Dostum's insurance policy? Could he be saying, if I get accused of war crimes, then I'll bring down the Americans with me?
What evidence did you see in the film of American involvement?
I saw lots of them at Shibar Khan prison. We can see it on the footage, Americans at Shibar Khan prison. You can see them standing by when they open the containers. There's a lot of footage of them.
He was machine or just Haile Mekan.
You can also see a few of them at Dasht Laili.
The Dasht Kam Diyar Mishat Asurishan Kamas.
For 8 days, Najibullah remained under armed guards we provided at a safe house far from Mazar until he was ready to travel.
The winner of the 2002 Rory Peck Award for Hard News is Najibullah Kiroshan.
And after recuperation in London lasting over a month, his bravery was recognised with a major award for work contained in this film.
I wish a safe and prosperous life for all the journalists in the world, without interference in their profession. And also, I would like to dedicate this award to the people of Afghanistan, my lovely country.
But without an independent inquiry into the events in northern Afghanistan, that bravery will have been wasted.
Najibullah Qureshi, accepting one of the highest awards in journalism, the Afghan researcher who tried to get the videotapes, which brings us to the end of this conversation. Jamie Moran, two quick questions. One is why the U.S. media, outside of Democracy Now! On Friday, has not broadcast this documentary. Did you try?
If I can maybe say very, very quickly, of course we tried to get many people to take it, and as you know, the state of the mood in America just now is very strange and rather frightening. I should tell you also that just a number of weeks ago I was down on the Afghan border. This is not known by anyone, but I shall tell you now because it's too late. I was down on the Afghan border to actually pick up a copy of the film in question. There are actually a number of copies around now. The man died 4 weeks ago. He was captured on the way over to meet me. I'd actually followed his instructions. I also had $50,000, I don't mind saying, in my pocket. I'd wanted him to go south to Pakistan. He insisted on coming north. Our communications had been done at the highest level. I brought my own security person in to try and ascertain how he could have been caught, how this could have happened, because they were waiting for him.
We have 30
and his
seconds.
His answer was, it could only have been done, arranged by a nation state.
Well, and you are saying?
I'm saying that America were involved.
Well, I want to thank you.
That was the implication very clearly from my own security experts.
And the Pentagon continues to deny your allegations.
But Pentagon have tried everything. They denied the entire thing to begin with, then admitted this, and finally admitted that. And effectively, it broke down to the Pentagon having, you know, at least 50 and anything up to maybe 75, 100 plus special forces soldiers there walking about with blindfolds on for 10 days. That's if you accept the Pentagon's way. And let me tell you the one hope I have. I know many, many American Special Forces soldiers. These are extremely brave, brave
men. 5 seconds.
They will have been disgusted by what they saw, and they themselves will come forward.
Jamie Duran, filmmaker, author, produced the film Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death. That does it for the show. Our website is democracynow.org. The show is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Elizabeth Press, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman.